Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Mary, and I too would like to welcome everyone today to our workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Metastatic Breast Cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have over 1,050 people on this call, so it's really a credit to each of you, and you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities, and you come from small cities. You come from suburban areas, and you also come from rural and frontier communities. We also have international participants from Africa, Australia, Canada, Egypt, Hungary, Ireland, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and I want to turn your attention for a moment to all those materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline our speakers have prepared, and there's information about all of the collaborating organizations, which are just a terrific resource for all of you. And there is an evaluation form. I'm going to ask you to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics and the programs you would like us to offer? Indeed, today's program and the topic of metastatic breast cancer and its progress in treatment is one that has been recommended by many of you, and so we're offering it. And so we very much try to offer the programs that you request us to do. It just it makes good sense, and it's what you need. Now, I would like to say that today's program is made possible by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, we have wonderful faculty on our program today. Just really, they're not only are they expert speakers, but they also are incredibly compassionate speakers as well. They're just terrific. And our first speaker today is Dr. Erica Mayer. And Dr. Mayer is Staff Physician, Breast Oncology Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Instructor in Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Mayer is going to provide an overview of metastatic breast cancer, and she's also going to discuss with you the standard of care. I'm now going to turn the program over to Dr. Mayer.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. Welcome, everyone, and thanks for joining the call today. A diagnosis of metastatic or stage 4 breast cancer has changed significantly in the past several years, mostly due to progress in the treatment and supportive care for this disease. Every year, about 40,000 people are diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer. However, as people are living longer and longer, the overall number of people living with metastatic disease is now in the hundreds of thousands. Our contemporary goal overall in treating metastatic breast cancer is to control it like a chronic disease, similar to diabetes, where there needs to be attention continuously to therapy, but otherwise people maintain a normal life and normal activities, including working, caring for children, traveling, spending time with family and friends. Overall, our goals of care are twofold. Number one, of course, is to prolong survival. But number two, equally important, is to control symptoms and maintain quality of life. The primary method of therapy is systemic treatment. This means taking a medicine by mouth or by vein that goes all over the body and can treat cancer wherever it is. There are three main categories of systemic treatment that we use. The first one is endocrine, also known as hormonal therapy. The second is chemotherapy. And the third category is biologic therapies. This is a relatively new category, which includes medicines that target cancers, but in and of themselves are not chemotherapy. Primary examples in this class are trastuzumab, known as Herceptin, and bevacizumab, known as Avastin, both of which are antibody treatments. Local therapies like surgery or radiation treatment are not used as often as they are with early stage breast cancer, however, are typically considered adjunctive and can be used in a situation when there's cancer in a location causing a symptom, for example, if there's pain coming from a bone. Rather than giving several therapies at a time, our preference is to give fewer agents at a time, often just one, using a dose and schedule that's designed to reduce side effects while maintaining activity of the medicine. In general, treatments are given continuously as long as they are being tolerated well without significant toxicity or until there's a sense that they're definitely not working. This can be determined by a combination of information, and this includes radiology scans, blood tests, and most importantly, how someone's feeling. If a treatment's found not to be working as well as we want, then we change to something that's more effective. We also sometimes consider combining medicines in situations when we need a fast response, although this can cause more side effects, so it tends to be reserved mostly for special situations. Much of the treatment decision-making in metastatic breast cancer involves personalization and tailoring of treatments to both the characteristics of the tumor, but also the medical history and the preferences of the person with cancer. There's no one standard approach, and each person with metastatic breast cancer may receive a unique sequence and selections of medicines for treatment. We used to think of metastatic breast cancer as one disease coming out of one organ. However, today, in contemporary medical oncology, we have a much more sophisticated understanding of this disease. We generally divide breast cancer into categories that are defined by the results of testing for receptors on the outside of cancer cells. This includes hormone receptors like estrogen receptor and progesterone receptor and the HER2 receptor. The general categories we use include hormone receptor positive breast cancer, which comprises about 60% of people, HER2 positive breast cancer, this occurs about 20 to 30% of the time, and a category that's called triple negative breast cancer, and this is defined by testing that's negative for the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2, and this occurs about 15 to 20% of the time. The treatments are thus selected based on the category of the disease. So, for example, if there's a cancer that's hormone receptor positive, then the endocrine or hormonal therapies are preferentially selected, and this includes medicines like tamoxifen, aromatase inhibitors, or fulvestrant, which is an injection medicine. Chemotherapy can be used for any type of cancer, and that can be given one chemotherapy medicine at a time or sometimes in combination. Sometimes we use the medicine Avastin, bevacizumab, in combination with chemotherapy as well. If someone has HER2-positive cancer, it's important to add in a medicine that targets the HER2 receptor, and this can include Herceptin, trastuzumab, or a newer medicine called Tykerb, lapatinib. In addition to medicines that are specifically directed against the cancer, there are other medicines or activities to consider which can provide benefit. For example, if cancer is in the bones, a bone-strengthening medicine like zoledronic acid, known as Zometa, or pimidronate, known as Aridia, can decrease pain and prevent more serious complications. Pain medicines may be needed if someone has discomfort, and optimizing pain control regimens requires close communication between a person with cancer and his or her doctor to make sure that the choice of medicine and the dose is correct. Attention to healthy nutrition can be helpful, and often through the cancer clinic, one can meet with a nutritionist. It's important to try to get regular exercise as well. This can improve one's tolerance of treatment. It can improve mood. And there's some emerging evidence that this may also help fight breast cancer. Some complementary therapies have been proven in trials to actually help with breast cancer as well in managing symptoms. And this can include acupuncture, acupressure, and massage therapy. Clinical trials are an exciting option to treat metastatic breast cancer and represent a complement to standard therapies. Many of our most exciting and effective medicines have been developed through trials, and being on a trial not only may help improve our ability to treat breast cancer, but also can allow exposure to new medicines. Being on a trial requires a conversation with one's doctor and the research team and careful review of an informed consent, which is a document that describes why a trial is being done and details the risks and benefits of being on a trial. At any point in treatment, one can consider being on a trial, so it's definitely worth talking about with one's doctor. At this point, I'll turn it over to Dr. Rugo, who's going to discuss in more detail clinical trials and some of the new treatment approaches.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mayer, for just an excellent and informative presentation, and just for starting off the call and putting the whole context for metastatic breast cancer in the context for everybody on the call. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And also for the lead-in next to Dr. Rugo, and Dr. Hope Rugo is our next speaker. And Dr. Rugo is clinical professor of medicine, director of Breast Oncology Clinical Trials Program, UCSF Comprehensive Cancer Center. Dr. Rugo has spoken on our programs on many occasions, and she is going to talk about the role of clinical trials, updates from ASCO and new treatment approaches, and how research contributes to treatment options. I'm now going to turn the program over to Dr. Rugo.
Hi, and thank you, Carolyn, for organizing this tremendous program, for all the work you do, and thanks for all the participants and my colleagues for also speaking on this program. I think it's a really great way to reach a lot of people and to have a conversation. Dr. Mayer, Erica did a great job of discussing metastatic breast cancer and then also broaching the topic of clinical trials. And I think that the whole thinking about clinical trials from the patient standpoint has really evolved over the last 10 years, where there's much greater understanding, in part because of the tremendous value of these kinds of educational programs, as well as the, I think, incredibly important and treatment-changing and life-altering results that we've seen from clinical trials over the last decade. And, of course, this builds on previous data, but we've made a lot of progress, not just in breast cancer, but in cancers we've previously thought of as being not responsive to therapy. And we saw some of that at our most recent ASCO meetings. ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, is a way for clinical oncologists worldwide to get together and talk about clinical research and also obtain education on what's going on in clinical research and laboratory research, how applicable it is to the clinic. Interestingly, ASCO also is a great forum for patients and for patient advocates. People come from all over the world to learn and to discuss and to understand new data. And this year, we had the opportunity to learn about a number of different trials that we'll talk about, and I think that these illustrate really nicely the role of clinical trials and how we're able to understand better what treatments benefit patients and what treatments might not benefit patients. Because although as clinicians and as patients, it's disappointing when a trial doesn't result in an improvement, it's really important because we wouldn't, on both sides, want to continue to use a treatment that wasn't benefiting patients and might be even causing more side effects. So what we build into our clinical trials are stopping rules so that we better understand when a treatment might not be as beneficial. You can, you know, people talk about this as the rule of one, you know, so you could do a trial with 20 patients enrolled and one patient benefits, but that doesn't mean that we're going to benefit lots of patients, and you're given a lot of side effects for maybe not a lot of benefit. But we wouldn't have known that. We could have done the next trial and seen that 30 patients benefit out of 40, or maybe 15 out of 40, and so that's a positive trial. So we learn along the way, and we talk to our patients, and we have stopping rules that protect our patients. We, you know, put results in newspapers before they're published and presented, early release of data, so that we can all learn and benefit as we move forward. So what did we learn from ASCO this year? A lot of people will say it wasn't a banner year for breast cancer because there were some very exciting results that came out for cancers we think about as being poorly treatable, like malignant melanoma, for example, and some new exciting therapies for melanoma and prostate cancer and other malignancies, even basal cell cancer of the skin. But for breast cancer, I think we continued to make significant progress in our understanding of treatment of metastatic disease. So one of the trials I think that's really worthwhile just discussing briefly was a trial that looked at a new chemotherapy drug for the treatment of metastatic breast cancer. And, you know, this is an era where we're really excited about targeted biologic therapies that Dr. Mayer discussed in very elegant outlined form. But chemotherapy is still important because we all know there are things about chemotherapy that we hate. We know that it works. We know that it helps women to live longer. But we don't know which drugs work the best for which cancers. But also we hate the side effects. You know, we hate peripheral neuropathy, tingling of the fingertips and toes. We hate hair loss. We hate low blood counts and fatigue. So we're still looking for ways to try and improve on the toxicity profile of these drugs and also to find drugs that work better and then lastly to find out which cancers respond the best to which agents. So having new drugs is a really good option. And, you know, the other thing that's interesting, one of our colleagues at MD Anderson looked at survival for metastatic breast cancer that's improved a lot over the last few decades. And then she paralleled the survival with the increasing availability of new chemotherapy drugs. And, you know, you can't make a direct parallel to, oh, we had 5 drugs this year as opposed to 3 2 years ago. But you can see that over time, the more drugs that are available has correlated with increasing survival and quality of life, functionality of women with advanced breast cancer. So this trial, EMBRACE trial, is actually a trial that was out in a press release a year ago, which is kind of interesting. It took them a long time to actually present it, and they're approaching the FDA now about getting this drug approved. So the EMBRACE trial looked at a new chemotherapy drug called eribulin. And eribulin, like all of our chemotherapy drugs, came from a natural substance but is now synthetic. It came from the marine sea sponge, and it's called a halochondrin analog. And it's very similar to chemotherapy drugs like taxanes, but its mechanism of action is more similar to drugs like navalbine or vinorelbine or vincristine, another older chemotherapy drug. And what they did in this phase 3 trial was very interesting. So they said that, okay, we've got a lot of competition in drugs that are given early in the treatment of metastatic breast cancer. So let's allow these patients who can't get into trials because they've gotten too many prior chemotherapy treatments to go on to this trial. So they allowed patients to have gotten 2 to 5 prior chemotherapy treatments for metastatic breast cancer. So that's different types of treatments, 2 to 5. So lots of prior chemotherapy. And you had to have gotten at least 2 treatments for metastatic breast cancer with chemotherapy and adriamycin and a taxane. And then patients were randomized 2 times the number to the eribulin as to the other arm, which was treatment of physician's choice. So that was also a great novel way of thinking at a trial, because what you want to do is allow not just some standard treatment that nobody wants to get that has too many side effects, right? You want to allow the physician and patient to make the choice if they're not going to go on the experimental arm. So they randomized patients, 760 patients, to receive eribulin, which is given IV weekly, 2 weeks on, 1 week off, over 2 to 5 minutes. It's a really quick IV infusion, no pre-meds, versus treatment of physician's choice. And they enrolled these patients. They had received a lot of prior chemotherapy, and most of the standard treatment that they got was either Xeloda or gemcitabine or vinorelbine, navalbine. And their primary endpoint in this trial was to look at survival. And, in fact, women who got eribulin lived longer than women who got the treatment of physician and patient choice. Interestingly, it was hard to show that the duration of response lasted a lot longer. It was a little complication between investigators and independent review group. But there was, and the response was higher in patients relatively who got the eribulin versus the treatment of physician choice. So they had more than double the response rate. So it's a really interesting study. Then they looked, that they showed that you could survive longer with this new chemotherapy drug. And then they looked at the adverse events, so how much toxicity patients got. And the main toxicity from eribulin was low blood counts. But that was managed pretty well. The rate of peripheral neuropathy was about 8%, so it was lower than many other drugs we give. And the other interesting thing is only about 30% of women lost their hair. So it's a very interesting drug, and I think we're going to learn more about how to incorporate it earlier into the course of treatment, and we're hoping that the FDA approves this drug in the not very distant future. What's fascinating is if you think about Avastin, Avastin studies, bevacizumab, didn't show a survival benefit. Well, they gave their drug in the first-line setting, so women who had metastatic breast cancer who hadn't gotten chemotherapy before. And it may be that it's much harder to see survival differences when you treat women very early in their course of treatment for metastatic disease. Now, the other things to just quickly mention are, we're learning a lot about anti-angiogenic therapy. There's a drug called sunitinib or Sutent approved for renal cell cancer and other cancers. And there were some randomized trials of metastatic breast cancer, none of which showed a benefit from adding Sutent. And the real issue is that this drug causes low blood counts and some mouth sores and skin sores, and they didn't really evaluate that well enough before they did these big trials. So I think it's very important for us to understand what the value is of a drug and understand what the right dosages are, et cetera, when we enter into these trials, and then to stop them early, as they have done in most of the cases with the Sutent trials, so that we know that it's not the right area to be studying. There's been tremendous interest in PARP inhibitors, these drugs that are used to block the ability of cancers to repair damage to DNA when you give chemotherapy. And there were a number of studies on PARP inhibitors presented, but they were all very early. And what we learned basically was that the PARP inhibitors are all different. They aren't the same. Some of them have more side effects than others. and we need to learn a lot more about them. There was a fascinating study in ovarian cancer where there's a specific subtype of ovarian cancer that responds really well to one of the PARP inhibitors, and that's going to be explored more. But in breast cancer, we've got still a lot of learning to do, and there will be compassionate availability of one of the PARP inhibitors, the intravenous one with chemotherapy, open across the United States either now or in the next couple of months as we wait for the results and look for what the FDA will say. And then just to sort of mention in closing the, you could talk forever about these results, but one thing we learned that wasn't a pharmaceutical study, it wasn't a new drug, but it's so important, and that is that there were three presentations in our oral session for metastatic breast cancer talking about the importance and validity of doing biopsies to document metastatic breast cancer. So if you're a patient with metastatic breast cancer, you just found out or you knew already and you have to change treatment, obviously you're going to be very hesitant about being poked with a needle into some organ to find out about the cancer because of pain and risk of bleeding. So as oncologists, we generally have steered away from biopsying, but now we understand that it's really, really important to biopsy. So these three presentations looked at how often the markers, estrogen and progesterone receptors and HER2-neu, are different in the metastatic tumor compared to the primary cancer that you had before you recurred. And the differences were quite substantial. They ranged from about 14% to as high as 49%. It turned out that if you have triple-negative breast cancer, it's unlikely that your markers will change. It only changed 7% of the time. But for other patients, the change ranged up to 45, 49% of the time. And in one study, they looked to see how often the change in markers actually changed treatment. And that happened about 12% of the time, and in one study, as much as 28% of the time. So the bottom line is we're learning more, as Dr. Mayer mentioned, and we're going to be able to use those biopsies actually for even more important purposes in the near future. So we're going to be able to take the tumor biopsy and say, this is the right treatment. You have the gene signature that can respond to this targeted biologic agent. And in the meantime, while we're learning that, we're being able to evaluate those tissue to move forward in clinical trials and get to that point is really important. And then just for you today, being able to biopsy a new site and know that it's metastatic breast cancer, that's what you have and not something else, and know what the markers are, is incredibly important for your treatment. So with that, there's lots more to talk about. We'll talk about it some in the Q&A. I'll pass it back to Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Rugo. Excellent presentation, really, and it's so informative and really, really cutting edge in terms of letting everyone know about the latest developments in treatment of metastatic breast cancer. Thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Lydia Shapira. Dr. Shapira is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Staff Oncologist, Gillette Center for Breast Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Shapira is really going to address symptom and pain management, communicating with your healthcare team, and quality of life concerns. And Dr. Shapira actually has done two programs for us this week, we're delighted to have her on the call again today. Dr. Shapira?
Thank you, Carolyn. It's such a pleasure to be on this call, and I've learned so much in the last 20 minutes. So what I'd like to do is slow us down a little bit and just get ready for Q&A. And while we do that, let me just reflect a little bit on what I heard and what other changes I've seen certainly in the last 20 years, both in research and also in clinical practice. One of the things we really understand much better is that there is a science of communication and that there are real benefits, tangible benefits, to communicating well with the healthcare team. So it's important to just take a step back and try to think about all of the dimensions that are affected by good communication, because in fact, if one is able to communicate clearly, if one understands and is able to articulate concerns and physical symptoms, that also will lead to more self-advocacy and will allow symptoms to be relieved better and perhaps improve quality of life, make a patient more suitable for a new treatment or even for participation in new clinical trials. So all of these things are really interconnected. One of the main changes in the way we think about this is that in the past, the advice flowed from the physician, and now it's really much more of a partnership. So at the core of a good therapeutic relationship is really a sense of partnership, that the patient, that you or your loved ones are really collaborating with and have a trusting and good relationship with the healthcare team. And it's not just the doctor and the patient, but really the healthcare team, which these days is really increasingly multidisciplinary. And not just the patient, but often patient and her web of supportive carers and loved ones. So it's really important to start out and form a solid relationship. In the past, we viewed the physician as the expert. Now we've reduced the role of the physician to an expert in disease, but we actually acknowledge and value the fact that a patient is an expert in his or her life and values and knows how many trade-offs she's prepared to make in order to have access to newer treatments or hang on to a very good quality of life. So, for instance, when Dr. Rugo was talking about the fact that physicians often are hesitant to ask patients to undergo additional biopsies or perhaps make some assumptions. She didn't say this, but I will guess about what a particular individual may or may not want. You know, in the past, we used to act on that much more. Now it's easier, and in the context of a healthy relationship, it's easier to just talk about things in a collaborative way. And if we can help our patients to get to the point where they actually are well informed and are able to say, look, you know, this I'm willing to put up with if it can benefit me, or this I'm really not willing to do because I need to preserve quality of life in order to care for my family, go to work, and bring in a paycheck, then it's easier to help guide each individual to make the best choice about her life. So as we think about metastatic breast cancer as a chronic illness, it's something that will require many conversations over time, many decisions, many trade-offs, and it's really important, I think, for each one of you or your loved ones or those who you will influence or advise to really be very clear about individual goals. You know, what is most important to me at this point in my life? Is it to be completely well, to be able to be with kids, to travel, to work, to perform, to finish my dissertation, whatever it is? If it's clear to you, if it's clear to the patient, and that can be articulated and communicated to the healthcare team, I think it leads to a much better dialogue. And in that case, we can really make personal decision and personal treatment recommendations based not just on the biology of the tumor, but on the preference of the individual who happens to harbor that tumor. So that's just one thing I wanted to make really clear. We are very enthusiastic about what we call shared decision making, and that means that we value the opinion of the expert in the disease and we value the opinion of the patient. If we are going to make good informed and shared decisions, then we need to be clear about just how that information is transmitted and negotiated and how the decisions are made. I certainly have had many patients, and I know this is well documented in the literature, who want to be completely informed, but when it comes time to make a decision, they want to leave it to me. And that's fine. Not everybody wants to know everything. Not everybody wants to know everything all the time. And I think it's very important that we be respectful and that we offer each other the possibility of information, but also respect those boundaries. That's important for any treatment decision, whether it's receiving a standard third or fourth line of treatment or the decision to participate in a clinical trial, which may be very attractive to some and offer a lot of hope and the idea of the excitement of being part of an important partnership to advance science, or may be seen as just more work, may require more visits and perhaps additional costs and additional procedures. So with that background, let's turn a little bit to what we talk about when we mention symptom management or quality of life. Quality of life really refers to all of the things that give life a certain flavor and what for some may be, you know, for some a certain profile of side effects may be very bearable and tolerable if you perceive there may be a benefit from having those because they mean that you're getting a certain treatment. For others, it may just mean that life is just uncomfortable and not worthwhile at all. So quality of life depends on what the patient reports. It's really a subjective assessment of how things are going. There are physical symptoms, which certainly we as oncologists are very comfortable asking about: nausea, hair loss, neuropathy, alterations in blood sugar and energy, and levels of physical discomfort such as pain or joint stiffness and so on. But there are other dimensions that affect quality of life that are not just the physical symptoms that we can quickly talk about and blurt out, and those have to do with how one functions in role as a mother or a sister, a professional, a wife, also how one functions in a social role, whether or not one has time to actually go to the movies or go to the concert or do some social activity that may be meaningful through a group or in society, whether it's attending a religious service or just a pleasurable event. So there are many dimensions that go into what we consider quality of life that have to do with emotional well-being, whether or not one's anxious or depressed, whether one's happy or at least accepting and calm, whether one can function in the roles that one has chosen for oneself in life. And then, of course, the physical function that is more likely affected by either the disease or the treatment. And let's face it, as Dr. Rougeau reminded us, many of our treatments, which have really, really improved the landscape of the treatment of this disease, also have associated symptoms, and it's the burden of those symptoms that sometimes causes considerable suffering. So it's important to think about what those symptoms are, to be as precise, as informed as possible in reporting those back to the healthcare team, and also to recognize that any discomfort, any form of pain is worth talking about with the healthcare team. I often tell my patients that I think I'm a very good doctor, but I'm a very bad mind reader. So if I don't hear that they're in pain, if I don't know where the pain is, how bad it is, and how it affects their daily life, I'm really not able to help them solve it. So doctors in general love to fix problems, and we're pretty good about trying to find solutions and calling in colleagues. And certainly there are a large number of medications that can be used to treat pain or any discomfort. There are non-medicinal interventions. Sometimes there are physical therapy or occupational therapy techniques we can use to relieve certain kinds of pain. Sometimes there are certain exercises we can show. There are all sorts of ways to creatively deal with any form of physical discomfort or pain. It's very rare that somebody really has to live with a large amount of pain this day and age, but in order to relieve it, doctors need to know that it's there. And I think the patient professional team need to have a good and ongoing dialogue, which needs to be refreshed with information on a regular basis. So I think that pretty much has taken up my time. As you can tell, I tend to talk a lot, so I'm going to turn it over to Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Shapiro. That was really wonderful and really helping people to look at really their management of any concern, symptom, pain management, and also just the quality of life, being able to do things that really enrich one's life. So thank you very much. I know there'll be questions for you as well during the Q&A. And before we take questions, our next speaker is Patricia Spicer. Pat Spicer is an oncology social worker. She's our breast cancer program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Pat is going to go over with you some of the free services that you can access from Cancer Care. I now turn the program over to Pat.
Oh, thank you, Carolyn. As somebody who has worked with patients directly and in the patient advocacy community, this was an especially exciting presentation. For the first time, women with metastatic breast cancer their needs are being recognized. There is a great deal more going on in terms of development of treatment, and the sense of isolation and being sort of second-class citizens in terms of breast cancer is moving forward so that they are getting the recognition and the support that they need. There's been a lot of evidence of support for people with early stage breast cancer, but women who are in the metastatic portion of the illness have felt sort of isolated and neglected. At Cancer Care, we want to help you to ease that as well. And as you can hear, there is a great deal of emphasis on helping to move this particular group of women forward to obtain what they need for themselves. If you're having difficulty coping with some of the things, your treatment, your family, the issues that come up day to day, Cancer Care would like to be of help. You can reach us online at www.cancercare.org, and on our homepage you can register for our online support groups. You can also reach us by calling 1-800-813-4673 and speaking directly with a social worker or registering for a telephone support group or setting up some face-to-face counseling or online counseling or phone counseling as well. We also offer support groups and in face-to-face as well as in the other modalities and these wonderful Connect education workshops that Carolyn is so good at organizing. So we're here for you, and we want you to help. And just as we want you to be able to talk to your doctors when you need someone to talk to hear your concerns, we'll be glad to do it. So please contact Cancer Care. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Pat, for really demonstrating to everybody the services that we offer. And Pat is, of course, one of our wonderful social workers here in terms of the breast cancer program. And just feel free to contact us for those services. And now we do have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring on all of our speakers so they're all available to answer your questions. And then I'm going to ask her to explain to you how to queue up for questions. Now, I just want to say one thing. We're a lot of you on the call, so we may not get to everyone's question. And if we don't get to your question, please just call the 1-800-813-HOPE number after the teleconference, and we will do our very best to answer your questions. So we're here for you. Okay, Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, then press the pound key. Our first question comes from Allison S.
My question is, 4.5 years ago, I had a whole brain radiation for 8 tumors in my brain, and I'm having trouble finding anyone else that has these long-term effects, side effects. I was wondering, my doctor doesn't seem to know anyone who's had long-term whole brain radiation long term ago. Do you have any suggestions for resources for patients living?
Yeah, I do. You might want to contact Living Beyond Breast Cancer. Online you can get them at www.llbc.org. And there's also Survivors HZ, which is www.survivora2z.org. Both of those organizations can put you in touch with people who are long-term survivors, and they might be able to contact to connect you with someone who has had a similar experience.
I think that this is Dr. Rugo. I think what you're pointing out is something really important to just comment on, which is that, you know, we do have patients now who are living a very long time after having brain metastases where, you know, that wasn't the case, for example, when I first entered oncology of now a very long time ago. And so, you know, there aren't, like, great publications about what happens to women with breast cancer who had a whole brain radiation and are, you know, doing okay a number of years later. But we can actually look into the literature from children who got whole brain radiation for leukemia and then, you know, were long-term survivors because they used to do it preventively. And that helps some. I think a lot of the radiation oncologists are quite familiar with that. I think the resources you just heard about allows you to talk to other people and hear what they've had. I have found that if you can find at an academic center a memory and aging clinic, that they can be very, very helpful with some of the side effects that patients experience long term after a whole brain radiation.
Anyone else want to comment? Dr. Shapiro?
I think that in addition to what Dr. Rugo said, you know, I too have anecdotal experience having cared for many women who've had whole brain radiation, and it's important to be as informed as possible about possible long-term effects as they affect memory and function and so on. But then, you know, hopefully, optimistically, you go forward, and certainly that there are you are in the company of many others who are long-term survivors of radiation.
There's some online programs, just to mention, one in particular out in California where you can actually go on and do these kind of cognitive exercise programs, and those people have found to be also very beneficial.
And that's an excellent point. I think that for many women undergoing a variety of treatments for breast cancer, and I think your question in terms of the whole brain radiation is a very excellent one, that often if you're noticing some impact on your thinking and memory and word retrieval, that within your where you're getting your care, you can ask also to speak to some of the rehabilitation staff there, because there are a number of techniques and methods that can be recommended to help to compensate for anything that you may find is not, you feel that may have lost some memory or thinking of capability. So also take advantage of those services. They're often provided by social workers, psychologists, psychiatry departments, just that they have a rehabilitation therapist that have this expertise that could be very helpful to you as well. So that's an excellent question. That really could be its own, the more I think about it, its own program, its own Connect workshop. So thank you for raising that. Really excellent question. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Margie G.
Hi there. This is a question for Dr. Rugo. I was fascinated by the information about how during a biopsy, sometimes the markers can actually change, and that you ASCO had mentioned possibly redoing a biopsy or at the new spot that has occurred. If the biopsy spot would be in the middle of the sternum, let's say, which was where my reoccurred, that would involve collapsing my lungs, et cetera. How do they weigh the benefits and the consequences of taking a biopsy?
Great question, Dr. Rugo.
It is a great question, and here's the thing is that, you know, you're always going to be weighing risk versus benefit when you're talking about biopsies, treatments, getting on an airplane, you know. It's just that some things we take more, you know, we're better informed about the risks. And so when you have a risk of, say you have a sternal lesion, what you want to do is get a really expert person to do the biopsy. You could also, let's say you have a single lesion in the sternum and you had hormone receptor positive disease, you could do hormone therapy and then say, well, that's a pretty good guess, and then I'm going to wait, and when it changes, then I'm going to do a biopsy, or if it doesn't work well, I'm going to do a biopsy. You know, you can weigh the risks and benefits and when you're going to do the biopsy. But what we've done is identified a radiologist that we can work with, and then somebody in interventional and somebody in neurologic imaging, where we can biopsy really hard to biopsy slots pretty reasonably. And so that's how we've performed these, and basically we provide that service for people as far away as 5 hours, where patients will come to get a biopsy because we have the expertise to do it and they don't have it in the community, and then we have the pathology support as well. I think one area where it's particularly difficult is, too, actually, you have a little tiny lesion in the brain, and that's the only thing you have. You know, you can't get that out. So you just – what we've done with that in one young woman recently is to treat it with gamma knife radiation, so focused radiation, and then just wait. And then the other thing is you could have a lung nodule that's really hard to reach without causing a pneumothorax or a lung collapse, as you pointed out. And in that situation, sometimes, you know, if you absolutely need to know what it is, you have to go to your thoracic surgeons and do a little mini type of surgery where they go in and take a little bit of the tumor. There are situations where you just can't biopsy it and you got to wait. But I think that the issue is that many oncologists will take that as the easy road out, and we need to be thinking about it a lot harder.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks. Excellent. These are great audience. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Esther.
Hi. This is a question for Dr. Rugo. Actually, can I ask two questions?
Go right ahead. As long as they're just
all right,
go right ahead.
The first one is I've been metastatic for 9 years, and I had 3 treatments that worked, and now I've been through 4 treatments that did not. My question is there such a thing as chemo resistance, or do I still have hope of finding something that could work again.
And your second, was that the whole question, or is there another piece to it?
The second question is, I wanted to find out who was doing the PARP compassionate use, which drug company.
Okay, excellent. Okay.
So I'm going to quickly answer the second one, and then I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Mayer to answer the first one. So the second one, the PARP trial, it's a company called BiPARP, which is now owned by Sanofi Aventis. It's the trial that was presented and the phase 3 trial that just closed. So the drug is BSI-201. And basically, if you go onto the National Cancer Institute patient data query and you search PARP, you can find that it lists all the sites that are open. And basically, there's a contact, and they can help you, if it's far away from you, find out if newer sites have opened near to you. Erica.
And I just want to say, if you don't, for some reason, have access to the Internet, you also can call the 1-800-4-CANCER, the number 4-CANCER. It's actually in all your materials. So either way, you can reach someone who can help you, walk you through this. And Dr. Mayer, next part of that question.
Thank you. So, Esther, congratulations on 9 years. That's really wonderful. What you point out is something that can happen over time in the setting of metastatic breast cancer, which is as cancers are successfully treated with different treatment regimens, the cancers become pretty smart, and they learn how to evade the types of treatments that we give. They develop resistance mechanisms such that a treatment that initially was working eventually stops working. And it's time for us to change gears, pick up a different weapon, and try to hit it hard again. In situations where cancers are not responding to a certain class of chemotherapy or other treatment, it's often best to try to pick a different treatment that has a different mechanism of action and may be able to overcome some of the resistance mechanisms. Some of the data that Dr. Rugo presented from the EMBRACE trial using eribulin points out this point, in that the women in that trial had received several prior lines of treatment and had developed some element of resistance. And yet, by giving them a new chemotherapy that had a somewhat different mechanism of action, for a good percentage of women on that study, that was able to achieve a benefit. And so this is why often changing to a different medicine is helpful. Additionally, thinking about the use of biologic therapies can be helpful as well, as these may augment the activity of a chemotherapy, or these may actually be targeted to overcome resistance mechanisms. Often some of these biologics are the medicines that are available in clinical trials. And so often after having received multiple lines of different treatments, it's often a good time to be looking into clinical trials and seeing if there's something that's a good fit for you.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Okay, our next question. Thank you.
Our next question comes from LCH. Elise, if your line is open,
I'm sorry, I didn't realize. Yes, I have neuropathy in my right leg, and I was wondering how you treat it. Is there any, I've been given Lyrica and Vicodin, and it's very painful, and I was wondering if they had any better recommendations.
Thank you. That's an excellent question. Dr. Shapiro, could you address that question?
Sure. So that's a very uncomfortable complication. Treating neuropathic pain is not really easy, and if it was caused by chemotherapy and by a taxane drug, to make it even more complicated and challenging, we don't really have an excellent model for how these drugs cause nerve pain. There are some basic models, but we don't have a very, very good idea. So our treatment is a bit limited and is directed at treating nerve pain in a more generic way. The drugs that you received, typically we start with a drug called gabapentin or Neurontin, and then we move on to this drug Lyrica, which is a newer formulation, are some of the more effective treatments. Vicodin is just a generic analgesic, so I think that what they've been trying to do for you is to keep you comfortable, and it's sort of challenging that it hasn't worked. At this point, there is no one drug that I can tell you that will work for you, but it's worth pursuing. I would recommend that you see a neurologist who has a special interest or expertise, and each one of us sort of knows who the local people are to refer to. But if, with the help of your oncologist, you can locate a good neurologist, I would recommend that you start there with an evaluation. I've had some patients who've been given some interesting and creative regimen of medications that help deal with nerve pain.
Thank you very much. And also, I know we've done programs on this topic, and so seeing a neurologist is very important, as Dr. Shapiro has said. Also, sometimes your neurologist may work with a doctor of rehabilitation medicine to help you with any balance issues you may have or other issues that may come along with the neuropathy. So it's really very helpful to have this whole team to kind of to help you to deal with this. So thank you. It's an excellent question. Thanks. Our next question, please.
I just wanted to make one other
comment
very quickly that we use our – we have a symptom control clinic, which helps a lot, and some programs have that. But also we use our anesthesiologists who do injections for nerve pain sometimes. And if you have a nerve that where somebody can identify, you know, by MRI scan, for example, that you have a little nerve compression in your lower spine that's causing the pain down your leg, sometimes injecting that area can be really helpful. So anesthesia is another place to go, pain management person.
Carolyn, also some of our patients have used acupuncture.
Absolutely.
In situations, and have found that it's been very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Good thing to mention.
And the concept of the pain management team, many of your institutions have pain management teams, and they can be, they're multidisciplinary. They represent many different expertise, and that's another, there are some other professionals who might be able to help, other healthcare professionals who may be able to help as well. Thank you. Okay, great. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Lynn F.
Hi. These two questions are directed to Dr. Rugo. Getting back to the discovery that it's important to ascertain if a metastatic site has mutated, I was curious if a person has multiple metastatic sites, liver, lung, bones, should each one of those sites be biopsied to ascertain if it's definitely breast cancer, and secondly, what the markers look like? And then my second question is, if a person has brain mets, if they're suspected, should a spinal tap be performed to rule out leptomeningeal spread?
Very good.
Thank you for those questions.
Sorry, Carolyn. Excellent questions, and those are fairly straightforward answers. So we usually just choose the safest spot to biopsy. So if you have multiple spots, you know, and one is the liver or a peripheral lymph node or a skin nodule, those are usually the three easiest sites to biopsy. We assume that the sites are similar. I think one time where you might want to biopsy a different site would be if you have one site that's shrinking and one that's growing, which sometimes we see and we call it a mixed response. But otherwise, we just biopsy one specific site. And if anybody has any other comments in the group, let me know, because maybe other people do it differently. But and then for brain mets, we don't do a routine spinal tap for patients who have brain metastases. We do it in two specific situations. One is when the MRI shows enhancement of the lining of the brain. We do it then. And second is obviously when we have neurologic symptoms that we can't explain, or neurologic symptoms in the form of nausea and vomiting without new brain lesions. Anybody do anything different in terms of the biopsy through the spinal tap?
No. No, that's what we do.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Marjorie J. Marjorie, your line is open.
Hello. I have a question. I had lobular breast cancer, which has metastasized to my bones as blastic lesions. And I'm wondering about the role of or the advisability of Zometa in my situation. I don't have high blood calcium or bony pain.
Marjorie, thank you for that excellent question. I'm going to ask our physician to address this in a general way, and then we hope you'll take this back to your treating healthcare team. Dr. Shapiro, would you be able to address this question?
Sure. I was actually going to ask Dr. Mayer what she does.
Yes, okay. So is that.
Well, you know, we do tend to offer Zometa or zoledronic acid for any of our patients who have bone metastases, whether lytic or blastic. The main goal of giving Zometa is to reduce bone pain associated with bone metastases and also to prevent side effects, which can include a fracture of the bone if the bone gets thin or the need to provide radiation to a bone. Receiving Zometa or zoledronic acid is not a mandatory thing, and it can be optional. Additionally, there are some toxicities of the medicine that we do think about in people who've gotten a fair amount of it, including some problems with bone healing in the jawbone. So one could consider taking it, but it's not a mandatory thing.
I would just add to that that I completely agree, and I just wanted to add on that, you know, we use it if people have pain, I think, more than if people don't are completely asymptomatic from the blastic lesions because of the reduction in pain that's been seen with the bisphosphonates, particularly with selegrenate. And then the second thing was just that there's a new agent, denosumab, that has been tested against selegrenate and, you know, will be probably FDA approved in the next year or so. So I'd look for that drug.
Yeah, and in terms of quality of life, you know, we can imagine that going forward we'll have, as Dr. Rugo mentioned, a choice. We'll have more than one agent, and the beauty of the newer agent is that it can be given, it can avoid the intravenous infusion. It's very quick. It's given under the skin and requires no laboratories to be checked. So I think as we move forward, there'll be even more options that will make quality of life better for women who have bone metastases.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank our speakers today. You have just been extraordinary. And I also want to thank all of you who've asked such great questions. And I think the and also those who have been listening on the call today. And I think the last note from Dr. Shapira in terms of just that there are increasing options for your treatments, and we want to be sure a program like this provides you with that information and that you continue to get more information as it really evolves. And I also just want to say that this is a one-hour program and that we recognize in planning a program like this that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I want you to know that although our workshop today is going to end shortly, the services that you can access for free from Cancer Care, those are endless and will continue as long as you need them. And I just want to remind you that we have a staff of 60 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we are here to help you, to provide practical and financial assistance, to provide someone to talk to about your concerns. We have counseling programs. We have support groups both on the telephone, so telephone support groups, as well as online support groups. We also offer a number of these different types of workshops, as you're on today, and a lot of materials and educational materials that we have available to you. And we're probably a good place to call when you have a question or don't quite know where to turn, so that you have a place to kind of think of for getting help. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I would not want anyone to feel that they're alone in coping with metastatic breast cancer or coping with cancer in general. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support and that we are here for you and that we have many programs and services that you are available to you really at the click of your mouse on your computer or by just picking up the phone and calling our 800 number. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.